Good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen. With that gavel, I have just convened the Subcommittee on Transportation and Economic Development for June the 14th, 2017. We are gathered today for the purpose of a public hearing on Senate Bill 256 relating to the Willamette Falls Navigation Infrastructure and a public hearing on House Bill 3279 relating to the regulation of property service contractors. I will now open the public hearing on Senate Bill 256. I believe, Eric, if you wouldn't mind getting the sign-up sheet, but I have a sneaking suspicion that the first panel might include Governor Roberts, might include former Congresswoman Hooley, might include Commissioner Schrader. Would that be a safe bet?
You got the...
Oh, and I didn't even see my colleague. Given the tradition of the building, I would invite Senator Devlin to come forward first.
Yes. Madam Co-Chair? As these dignitaries are sorting out who goes first, I just wanted to indicate that the House is scheduled to go back into session at 2 o'clock. I think the members will remain here and try and get some work done in this committee, but as you well understand, we may be subject to a call if that evolves to that point.
Thank you very much. Senator Devlin, welcome.
Thank you, Madam Co-Chair and members of the committee and Co-Chair Gomberg. I want to thank you for this opportunity and your reference to dignitaries. I think that's the next group coming up, actually, not me. And as you notice, I have my obligatory breakfast of champions, but in my case, it's breakfast, lunch, and dinner. For the record, Senator Richard Devlin, Senate District 19. I come to speak in support of SB 256 and reopening the Willamette Falls locks. I would also like to thank the legislature for passing SB 131 in the 2015 session, as it established the state task force, which has now completed its recommendations and laid the groundwork for Senate Bill 256. I would also like to thank the Honorable Governor Roberts for her advocacy on this issue and for her guidance on the state task force. As a state is something to be proud of, the Willamette Falls is the second largest waterfall in the nation, and the locks are truly a national treasure. Metro, Clackamas County, West Lynn, tribal governments, businesses, advocates are united in their advocacy for the repair and reopening of the Willamette locks. Reopening the locks provides a great opportunity for our economy, including increased commerce and tourism, as well as recreational, cultural, historic, transportation, and other opportunities. SB 256 implements the recommendations of the task force. It has two main parts. The first part would establish a Willamette Falls Locks Commission. The 23-member commission will be represented by members from tribal tribes, local governments, state parks, ODOT, stakeholders, as well as a number of representatives from the legislature. This bill would bring interest to the locks together in a collaborative process to work together and negotiate with the Army Corps of Engineers on behalf of the citizens of Oregon. You may be surprised if you read early fiscals on this bill, but the amendments that will ultimately come to this bill when it goes into work session, that fiscal is going to be $190,000. So it will be significantly less than what we have here, and that reflects, quite honestly, the times that we are in this session. You will hear from members of the task force. I'm looking forward to the testimony, particularly of the dignitaries behind me, not myself, but the dignitaries behind me. And I look forward to the bill ultimately moving on to the full committee. If I might go beyond my written remarks and just say a few things extemporaneously, this is an interesting issue because what we're dealing with, in effect, is the locks themselves and the future of the locks, because the Army Corps of Engineers is moving much faster than we ever anticipated to make their final determinations of what the ultimate will happen to the locks. If we are not prepared to have an alternative to some of the alternatives the Army Corps of Engineers may propose, they may permanently dam the locks, which will make them unusable anytime in the future, or they may actually fill in the locks, which will make them permanently not usable in the future. That will be very problematic because of ever having, again, river access from the lower and upper portions of Willamette. It will be very problematic because we all in this room have a very interesting and complete and sometime positive and sometime negative history. I have to put all those on the record, both the native people of this land and the people that ultimately inhabit it now also. But we have very few things left in this state that are really part of that history, that are intact. The very building we're in only dates from about 1938 when it was completed. We have very little left in this building. We have replicas of some things. The fort in your district is actually the third replica or fourth replica. This is actually the original locks. This is actually a part of Oregon history. It's in a location that is all at the core of Oregon's history and the history of the Oregon Territory. It would be a shame if this body and all the parties that are part to this didn't come to some agreement. It has been difficult to resolve some of the issues on this bill. There still may be issues to resolve. I'll just put that on the record. But it would be a shame if we are not prepared to come forward and basically make our case to the Army Corps of Engineers that the locks should actually be transferred to someone. They will provide some funding for that, is my understanding, and that we are able to maintain one of these few remnants of state history that is actually the original facility that was there. I'm not speaking so much for myself because I don't anticipate being on this earth that much longer, but I do think we owe it to future generations that they realize some of the origins of this area. And also to the tribal interests, because this will also help tell their story. So I'm just speaking very much in favor of this legislation, and I'm sure the people who follow me up will do a much better job than I have done.
Thank you, Senator Devlin. Colleagues, any questions of Senator Devlin? With all respect, Governor, I'm going to change the batting order here a little bit and ask that our representatives of the sovereign nations come forward first. And there is one that's asked to come together as a panel, and that is the Umatilla tribes and the Grand Ronde tribes, Jeremy Wolf and Ms. Kennedy. And I think that Senator Hansel would like to join the Grand Ronde panel. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you.
Ms. Kennedy, would you like to go first?
Sure. Good afternoon, Co-Chair Johnson and Co-Chair Gromsberg and members of the committee. My name is Cheryl Kennedy. I'm the Vice Chair of the Confederated Tribes of Grand Ronde. I'm here today to, by and large, say that the Confederated Tribes of Grand Ronde supports Senate Bill 256. We agree that this is a good bill to move forward with. We do. We are taking some time to perhaps add some language changes, but in essence, it would not change moving forward with the bill. But while I have the mic, I just want to give a little bit of background about the Confederated Tribes of Grand Ronde. The Confederated Tribes of Grand Ronde also carries the Willamette Valley Treaty that was signed January 22nd in 1855. Prior to that, we had a letter from the a request to the president that basically laid out the areas and concurred on by the President Buchanan that the areas we're talking about are for the Confederated Tribes of Grand Ronde, the Klaweewawala people. They were a tribe, and still all of the descendants remain within the tribe today. We were the keepers of the falls. Signer of the treaty was also Oregon City John, along with his Indian name that is on the treaty itself. The Willamette Falls was occupied by our people, and there are other tribes who came and visited. Part of the protocol for visiting the falls and taking from its bounties were the agreement of protocol, and the protocol was this, that if you could prove that you were related to the people, of the falls, then you were granted fishing rights. If you were not, then you were required to establish a sort of royalty or bounty of the take. So if you took 100 fish, 75 would go home with you, 25 would stay with the peoples. So those were ancient protocols that were developed way back when. We also know that concerning the way that Oregon deals with tribes is really based on the consultation process, because we are the treaty and the owners, the only designated owners of that land. We're thankful that we're able to provide comment here today, and we view ourselves as the primary consulting tribe on any kind of legislation that would affect our homelands. So we support the bill. We will take some time to provide some language that is being worked on right now, and but by and large, it's a good product. When this idea even came about, I served on the Willamette Valley Historical Commission, and we talked about what we're talking about today, and it was a great project. When the temporary commission was established, we testified then. We continue to support its operation. We think that there's great value there. We want to make sure that cultural practices are instilled in this project from beginning to end. So I thank you for this time to provide comment. I do have a map that I want to include as far as our testimony. We do have written testimony. I'm just talking. But this will be included as well, and it bears the legal citations for our treaties, the boundaries, and the letter that was signed from the president.
Thank you very much. Colleagues, any questions for Vice Chair Kennedy?
Madam Co-Chair, I just have a statement. I want to thank the Confederated Tribes of Grand Ronde for the work that you have done and put into this whole multi-year process. And your involvement on the task force shows a real commitment to move this project forward while ensuring that the area's cultural and historical significance are kept at the forefront of our decision-making. It is important to me that we honor the state's government-to-government relationship, and that we recognize customary practices that are intrinsic to the traditions of the people who originally inhabited the Willamette Falls area. I want to make sure that it's on the record that the Confederated Tribes of Grand Ronde have been the only tribe that has been consistently engaged in the process from the beginning, and I appreciate your commitment to this project.
Thank you, Representative Meek.
Thank you, Madam.
Thank you, Representative. Any other comments or questions for Vice Chair Kennedy? Thank you very much for coming. We will now turn to Senator Hansel. Protocol would say that you would speak first. Do you wish to defer to the tribal representatives?
Yes, I'd prefer to have Jeremy Wolf go first.
Thank you. Mr. Wolf, welcome.
Thank you. And thank you for your time, Senator, Co-Chair Johnson and Gomber. I just have a prepared statement, and we'll answer any questions that you have at the end. Good afternoon, co-chairs and members of the committee. My name is Jeremy Wolf, and I'm the vice chair of the Confederated Tribes of the Umatilla Indian Reservation. I began fishing for lamprey at Willamette Falls in 1999, just as my ancestors did and have fished there since time immemorial. When our treaty with the federal government was signed in 1855, our tribal use of resources was seasonal. We fished, hunted, and gathered roots and plants from the Willamette Falls in the west to the plains of Montana in Wyoming. Because of this, our treaty reserves our right to gather our first foods in what is referred to as usual and accustomed places. Our treaty was signed by 36 members of the Umatilla, Walla Walla, and Cayuse tribes. Congress ratified the treaty as 12th Statute 945 on March 8, 1859. While it is not top of mind to those of you who charge in balancing the state budget and getting bills out of committee, our treaty was signed before Oregon became a state and continues to be actively referenced on fishing platforms and in modern day courtrooms from here to Washington, D.C. Our treaty rights are secured under the U.S. Constitution and have been specifically upheld in over a century of decisions and federal district courts, the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals, and the U.S. Supreme Court. This treaty right is property right protected by Fifth Amendment to the Constitution of the United States. See Muckleshoot Indian Tribe versus U.S. Corps of Engineers. Over the past 162 years, we have lived up to our responsibilities and obligations of this treaty, and we expect the citizens of the United States to uphold their responsibilities and obligations. As an elected official of the tribe, I'm here to work with you to ensure the commission will include a member who is well-versed in the intersection of federal and state law as it relates to tribes. We look forward to being a productive participant in decisions that will impact the entire region. When Senate Bill 256 was originally heard in February, there was an argument made against adding seats for tribes with established federal rights at the falls because the commission would become unwieldy. At that time, the proposed commission would have 11 members. We heard that message, and although it is not our first preference, we support the -3 amendments to have one seat for tribes who are a party to treaties signed in 1855. This means we would share a seat. I do think it's worth noting that we came to the legislature to convey our interest in adding two seats, and since that time, the bill has expanded to add 13 seats for a total of 24 commissioners. It will be a big tent, but we appreciate your commitment to ensuring the treaty tribes are a part of it. The Willamette Falls are a significant and important natural resources to all Americans, all Oregonians. Our associated property rights to this natural resource are guaranteed by treaty and federal law. To ensure their protection, our inclusion in this commission is a must. In April, the Corps of Engineers notified the C2IR that they were beginning the process to deauthorize the Willamette Falls locks and dispose of the associated lands. There is no time to waste, and we must move forward with an inclusive body to make sure all voices are heard. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Mr. Wolf. Colleagues, any questions or comments from Mr. Wolf? Senator Hansel.
Thank you, Madam Co-Chair and Representative Gomberg, Co-Chair and members of the committee. I come before you today. I've been involved a little bit because I represent District 29, which includes the reservation of the Confederated Tribes of the Umatilla Indian Reservation. And they asked, as did Senator Devlin and various members of the lobby, if I would get involved or help move this project forward. I reached out to the tribe. I met with them, the Board of Trustees, during Ledge Days, or Ledge Friday back in the district, and it became apparent how important this is to the treaty tribes of Eastern Oregon, which are two basic ones would be that have interest in this, are the Warm Springs and the Confederated Tribes, of which I represent. I cannot stress enough how important that treaty is. That is their Magna Carta. That is their Constitution. And we must uphold it and be honorable in the distribution and the how we apply that to our governance as the state of Oregon. And with that, we came up, or it was developed, the -3 amendments. And I'm here to both support the tribal leadership and the tribal members. My family, Jeremy, it was one of the best basketball players ever to shoot hoops at Weston McEwen High School. Grew up with my daughters. His dad and my sister were classmates. So I'm very much involved, both the politically and socially and with my heart with the people of the Confederated Tribes of the Umatilla Indian Reservation. So I'm here to support them, and I'm here to support the -3 amendments, and hope that we're able to move the bill with those amendments. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Senator Hansel. Colleagues, any questions or comments? Senator Monroe.
Yeah, very briefly. I'm an old history professor. I've studied the history of Oregon a lot, studied the history of the whole world and of the United States. And I've been around the legislature for 40 years now. there aren't many times that I really get excited about something. This project excites me. I'm getting older, but I'm going to be around several more years, hopefully, and I look forward to walking along the new walk and looking at the locks opening and closing as the ships once and boats once again pass up and down the Willamette River, and watching the native people fish for the lamprey. And this project is going to be a jewel for the whole state of Oregon. It's going to attract not only our citizens, both Native American and others, but it's also going to attract many people from other states who want to come and observe this beautiful historical relic as it's reconvened. You know, it's tragic when I drive by on 99 that, you know, you can't even see the falls. Now the falls are going to be open for everybody to see, and I'm just really looking forward to it. So I work really hard to keep healthy so that I'll still be able to walk along that boardwalk when it's completed and observe this beautiful jewel of Oregon.
Thank you, Senator. Any other comments for this panel? Thank you. Ms. Wolf. Oh.
Thank you, Co-Chair. Just wanted to make a statement to Mr. Meeks on the involvement of or the absence of the Umatilla tribes, and some of it is encapsulated in the statement. You know, our usual and accustomed areas takes us far and wide, but you know, we have some buffalo hunting that we've been addressing quite a bit, and you know, without an unlimited amount of resources, we have been actively pursuing many interests in our usual and accustomed areas, and this is just one of them. But to that, you know, we do have science that is going on in the Willamette River through Columbia River Intertribal Fish Commission. We have working science going on with the Warm Springs tribe as well. And so we are very interested and invested in this area. And so with that, I'd like to say thank you again.
Thank you so much for your testimony. Thank you for coming. Thank you, panel.
Thank you.
Ms. McGrew, you're in the building all the time, so I am going to invite the next panel to come up together, Governor Roberts, Congresswoman Hooley, and Commissioner Martha Schrader, please.
I'm not usually in the middle, but I will be this time. It's a place to
maybe
avoid.
Maybe the first time.
Welcome, Governor.
Thank you very much. Let me begin. I know you have a time issue you're dealing with, and I will submit my testimony, but I do want to share. Madam Co-Chair and Co-Chair Gomberg and members of the committee, for the record, I am Governor Barbara Roberts, and I was the convener of the Willamette Falls Locks Task Force established by this legislature in the 2015 legislative session. The legislature charged that task force to develop findings and recommendations for the repair and the reopening of the Willamette Falls locks, and we did that, which is why I am speaking with you today. First, I want to thank the legislators that participated on our task force work, Senators Devlin and Olson, Representatives Parrish and Barton. I would also like to thank representatives from the Oregon Department of Transportation, Parks, and the Marine Board for their contributions and insights. And also thanks were earned for representatives from local governments, the Confederated Tribes of the Grand Ronde, the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers, and members of the community. All of these people and these groups brought input and expertise to develop the recommendations for the legislation, which is now Senate Bill 256. Several of you on this committee are sponsors of the bill, and we appreciate your support. The principal conclusion of the task force embodied in Senate Bill 256 and in the -3 amendments that have been spoken of is to establish a state commission with clear charge to determine the future for the locks, with the likely result being a transfer from the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers to a new entity such as the state or local government or a special district or a consortium. I would like to elaborate on the need and the importance of following through on this particular recommendation. The Federal Corps of Engineers has initiated what they call a formal disposition study, meaning they're going to dispose of property, wherein they will carry out their due diligence to inform their decision on the future of the locks. An Oregon entity needs to be established with a clear line of authority and communication to interface with the Corps and represent the interests of the people of Oregon. The task force concluded this work doesn't fit squarely within the responsibilities of any single existing state or local organization, and therefore we recommended that a new commission be formed to represent the interests of local and regional governments in Oregon, the tribes, the businesses, and the state. The -3 amendments improve the makeup of the commission with the inclusion of representation from Clackamas, Marion, and Yamhill counties, affected citizens expansion of tribal representation, and recognition of representatives from business, tourism, cultural, and environmental agencies, plus our state agencies. At the state level, it is envisioned that three major state agencies will represent aspects of the locks that Oregonians care deeply about. Oregonians care about our cultural and our history. So State Parks is an appropriate agency in preserving the locks for our citizens, that and economic potential from cultural tourism. Business Oregon has an interest in the locks for tourism, as well as the movement of commerce on the Willamette River and future economic potential from the possibility of inland ports. ODOT has an interest in the marine transportation of goods and also the potential of using the river as a transportation route in the event of a catastrophic event. Other agencies also have interests in the locks. The Marine Board, of course, has an interest in boating and recreational watercraft. Oregon Emergency Management has an interest in the locks and the Willamette River as a transportation route should a catastrophic event ever occur. As governor, I've led all of these agencies, and I understand how difficult it can be to bring together departments and agencies together, but how important it is for our state that we facilitate this collaboration for projects that are of great significance, which this one obviously is, and that cross all kinds of departmental lines. We need to make this work together. The window of opportunity for this project and this bill is really here and now. The locks have deteriorated since they were closed in 2011. The Corps of Engineers is bound by federal law to invest in marine navigation facilities that produce economic benefit of national significance. With the shrinkage of the timber industry, there is no longer movement of huge tonnage of logs downriver through the locks. As a result, it is the intent of the Corps to dispose of the facility either to a transferee or as surplus property with the construction of a concrete bulkhead that would stabilize the water flow and permanently close the locks. The prospect of construction of a concrete bulkhead at this site raises significant environmental and cultural issues. It is vital for our region that we carry out our own due diligence to inform our decision on the future of the locks while negotiating with the Corps. We need to understand the engineering issues, the costs, the environmental consequences, the actual status of the title to the property, options for determining a transferee, and securing a funding source to repair and operate the facility. It is not sufficient, in my mind, to simply wait and have the Corps hand down their conclusion. Plus, very importantly, and this is really important, we now have a supportive federal piece of legislation in place, thanks to the hard work of Oregon's congressional delegation in the waning hours of the 114th Congress. This is called, this is the long version, the Water Infrastructure Improvements for the Nations Act, or shortly, the WIN Act. It was signed into law, and with that legislation, Section 1165 of the piece of legislation directed the Corps of Engineers, in this case, like this, of disposition studies, like the one they are considering, to consider the extent to which the property concerned has economic, cultural, historic, or recreational significance or impacts at the state, well, first at the national, of course, that's their legislation, but at the national level, but also then at the state or local level. So the key question for the disposition study is the level of funding the Corps will contribute towards repair of a facility that they want to transfer. In this new act, the language directs them to use a new standard. It is different because now they will consider not just the national economic impact, but they will look at the impact locally and statewide. So it's important that we have a state commission that is in place so that our local and state interests are united, and also that we have the opportunity to pursue and influence this new standard at the federal level. The locks, as you heard Senator Devlin say today, are a 143-year-old national and state treasure. They have value for their place in history and their cultural significance. However, the locks also present an opportunity for economic development in the region, especially when you consider the combination of the locks and the Legacy Project, which has been mentioned several times today, across the river at the former Blue Heron site. These two pieces will come together in a magnificent opportunity, economically, culturally, socially, tourism-wise. The timing is absolutely critical for Oregon. With the repair and the reopening of the locks, the Willamette River would once again be navigable above the falls. We are all in this room stewards of this treasure, and together with the Willamette Falls Locks Commission and the passage of this bill, we can begin to move actively forward. The design of the commission with the -3 amendments, and that's very important, is solid and more inclusive. The time for passage is now. Oregon will not likely get a second chance at this unique opportunity. So I strongly recommend your passage of Senate Bill 256 with the -3 amendments, and I thank you for allowing me to testify today.
Thank you, Governor. I hope you submit your written material. That is the most comprehensive review of the project that I have heard. Colleagues, the House will reconvene at 2. So with respect, I'm going to ask the next two witnesses to be brief. And I've gotten, we still have Ms. McGrew, and I got a signal from somebody who came in late who wants to testify. So may we move expeditiously, I ask respectfully. We have another bill that we have to do that is an important bill.
Okay, thank you, Senator Johnson and Gomberg. I know you're not a senator, Representative Gomberg. I'm members of the subcommittee. I'm Darlene Hooley, and I have been working to repair and reopen the locks for quite some time. I served on the Westland City Council, which is right next to the locks, in the 70s. then as a Clackamas County Commissioner, and also securing earmarks as a member of Congress. Today, I'm representing Clackamas County and the Willamette Falls Locks Working Group. The Willamette Falls and the surrounding area are a unique and special place in Oregon, and the locks are a treasure that we cannot afford to lose. The tribal traditions and the culture at Willamette Falls and the history of the locks are reason enough to maintain the locks for future generations. The locks are an engineering marvel. The oldest and most intact canal and leaf gate locks in the nation and are a primary historic asset for the region. Yet the locks will continue to be a vibrant part of our future. The locks will be used by our citizens for recreation and boating so that the Willamette River can once again be one river, not a river cut in half. When considering together with the Legacy Project and the public access to the falls, the locks will be part of the region's worldwide tourism draw. The locks will be used by businesses. You've got testimony from Willamette Concrete that they're going to move their goods through the locks. They could be used as a critical transportation if a catastrophic event. The list goes on. I mean, there are lots of reasons. I'm going to try to go the quicker on this. The locks no longer have enough benefit at the national level for the Corps of Engineers. The Corps intends to dispose of the locks, so we have a choice. We're either going to take them over, or we will never see them again. It's really that simple. We appreciate the leadership of Governor Roberts as a convener of the State Task Force and its recommendation to State Commission, which is before you today, Senate Bill 256. Local governments, advocates, and businesses have been collaborating and pushing to preserve the locks through the Willamette Falls Locks Working Group under the leadership of co-chair Commissioner Schrader. The working group supports Dash 3 Amendment to create a broad and inclusive membership for a formal commission to represent our citizens in determining the future of the locks. I also have to mention Senator Devlin, who's been terrific, and his assistant, Morgan, for all the work on the Third Amendment. Thanks to all the legislators who supported the locks and our sponsors of 256. I just want to leave you with this. We have a window. It is not a great big huge door. It's a window of opportunity to preserve the locks for its cultural and historic legacy and for the economic, transportation, and recreational opportunities for our future. I thank you for the support of the Dash 3 Amendment and Senate Bill 256. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Colleagues, questions for this witness? They're seeing none. Commissioner Schrader.
One day, who knows? But in any case, good afternoon, colleagues, Co-Chair Johnson and Co-Chair Gomberg and members of the committee. My name is Martha Schrader. I'm here today as both the Clackamas County Commissioner and as co-chair of the Willamette Falls Locks Working Group. And today I'm asking for your support for Senate Bill 256 and the Dash 3 amendments being considered. And as you already know, Senate Bill 256 aims to create a state commission to represent the local interests of the Willamette Falls locks while the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers works to divest from the facility. The amendments are essential because it clarifies the role of the State Commission as the lead stakeholder body advocating for the locks with the congressional delegation, the Corps, and, of course, the state. It broadens the membership of the State Commission to include, as we said, additional stakeholders, county, city, state agencies, legislative members, and, you know, really representing the diverse needs of the region. And finally, I think for the purposes of this committee, reduces the financial requests of the state by $400,000. We're able to make this cost reduction because of the generous contribution that the state has already provided to the locks in 2016 for a local economic impact study and stopgap repairs. I'm pleased to report the economic study is underway at this point. However, the Corps was unwilling to consider use of the remaining funds for temporary repairs, and pending the results of their ongoing disposition study, the Willamette Falls Locks Working Group feels the state funds would find better use funding the state Commission. So even though the Dash 3 amendments reduce the fiscal request, the budget of the State Commission will remain intact. I would really like to say, in conclusion, I obviously have lots of notes here.
We'll be happy to accept your testimony. Okay. We're rapidly running out of time.
rapidly. The issue is that, let me conclude with this. The U.S. Army Corps of Engineers released at the end of May their draft disposition study. This document outlines the Corps' alternatives for their disposition of the locks. I'm very pleased to let you know that the study recommends a disposition alternative that prefers transferring the facility to a new owner as opposed to a permanent closure. That was quite the dance on the dance floor to work with the Corps for such a long time and move this to fruition. So without a transferee, the Corps will pivot, and you'll, instead of having this wonderful facility open, you'll just get a big concrete bulkhead, and none of us wants that. So I'm going to ask for your support today for Senate Bill 256. Thank you very much for your time. I'm happy to answer questions, but...
Thank you, colleagues.
They don't want to ask any.
Thank you, panel, very much. I'm going to ask up Ms. McGrew and Mr. Engstrom, and that will be the conclusion of the testimony we're going to take on this bill. I would ask you to be the soul of brevity. You're both in the building all the time.
Thank you, Chair Johnson, Representative Gomberg, members of the committee. My name is Molly McGrew. I'm here to represent the Yakima Nation, so I'll be brief. I do have some prepared testimony that
we'll happily accept it into the record.
I just want to say thank you very much to everyone who's been working on this project for the last, it sounds like, couple of years. And the Yakima Nation is definitely new to Oregon in terms of having representation in this building. So we are deeply appreciative that the Grand Ronde, Umatilla, Warm Springs tribes are willing to work collaboratively with all the other stakeholders to include both treaty and non-treaty tribes as part of this commission. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Mr. Engstrom.
Good afternoon. My name's Rich Engstrom. I'm the president of the Oregon Concrete Aggregate Producers Association. I know you all think I'm here to testify in favor of building the wall, the concrete wall to block the locks, but I want to tell you I'm not. One of our members, Wilson Bill Sand and Gravel and Bernard Barge and OCAPA have been in this fight to keep the locks open since the beginning of this. It almost dates back almost my whole 20 years, but memory-wise, a good clear 10 years we've been trying to keep these locks open. Portland uses 30% of the aggregate demand in the state, the aggregate supply, to keep it running. Bernard Barge uses the lock to move aggregates from places where we can actually get it down into the Portland market. And that has been a critical, it's been critical transport system for commerce and moving valuable construction materials in an efficient and effective manner into the Portland market. We need those locks open. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you very much. Colleagues, any questions? Thank you, panel, very much. Co-Chair Gomberg.
Thank you, Co-Chair Johnson. Very briefly, we've heard Senator Monroe and Representative Meek speak already to the historic, to the cultural, to the environmental, and to the economic opportunities and responsibilities that this project presents. I was very pleased to work with Representative Barton 2 years ago on this, and I'm very glad to see the measure advance to this point and be before us. I just wanted to take a moment on a personal note, first of all, to say that I'm very pleased to see the vice chairs of the sovereign nations here today, particularly Ms. Kennedy from my district. But going back much further from my own experience in this building, some of you will know that I began in the Capitol as a legislative aide to then freshman Representative Barbara Roberts. And I'm so delighted to see her here today, as well as Congresswoman Hooley, who the following year was a member of the Education Committee that I was staffing at that time. So I'm so pleased to see both of you back here and to receive both your advocacy and your eloquence. Thank you so very much for your involvement in this project.
Thank you very much. Colleagues, any other comments on this bill? I'm going to close the public hearing on Senate Bill 256 and open a public hearing on House Bill 3279. Thank you very much for all the panelists that came and testified. And please submit your written testimony, and it will become part of the permanent record. All right. We have a paucity of time and a number of people signed up. We're going to start by asking Representative Leininger to come forward.
Co-Chair Johnson, as she's coming forward, I indicated that the House is reconvening at 2 o'clock. We are not required, of course, to have a quorum at this committee for her hearing. So I expect the hearing will continue until we've heard from the people that are signed up. If any of the House members choose to return to the floor so they don't miss any votes there, we can continue our work.
Thank you very much. Welcome, Representative.
Thank you so much, Co-Chair Johnson and Co-Chair Gomberg. I'm Ann Leininger from House District 38, Lake Oswego in Southwest Portland, and I'm really happy to be here in support of a bill that will take meaningful steps to help very vulnerable workers from being sexually assaulted at the workplace. This bill would address the fact that janitorial workers are intensely vulnerable to being assaulted, and in fact, there's a very high incidence of assault that was reported in a frontline investigative special that you may have a link to in your materials. It's really very compelling. A couple of weeks ago, the Washington Post highlighted an article in which an immigrant cleaning person had been assaulted during her job by someone who was in D.C. for the inauguration, and this person was a CEO, a millionaire CEO, and he ended up being fined $50 for the conduct, and she ended up having been visited at her home by his defense team and felt like she had to move and also felt like she had to quit her job. The power imbalance in this kind of situation is profound, and it requires government to step in and try to help people. So the issue is that janitorial workers often work alone at night. It's very often a job that is done by immigrants, sometimes non-documented immigrants, sometimes English language learning immigrants, often women. And because they may be cleaning an entire floor of a building on their own, it can be that the only person they interact with is the supervisor during a whole shift. And if that supervisor happens to be predatory, then we've heard direct testimony in the Judiciary Committee, and I have read of other testimony in which people are assaulted. And because these businesses have such low barriers to entry, and the work in this sector no longer is done in-house by companies, as was the case, I think, before the 80s, but increasingly it's done through contracting out and subcontracting out. In addition, companies can start up, employ a bunch of very vulnerable workers, and if something goes wrong, they can just dissolve and disappear. And so there's very little ability for the people who run these companies to get the training related to sexual assault prevention, discrimination prevention that is needed, and also for people who are survivors to have to be able to, bring an action or enforcement action or have boldly enforce their rights. So right now I'm aware of at least one lawsuit happening in Oregon where 15 janitorial workers being represented against a manager in this kind of situation. But what this bill would do is very specific and tailored. It would create a registry so that people who run these kinds of janitorial businesses would have to essentially register so that we would know their addresses, the contact information, and you could go to them if there were actually a complaint. And these business owners would have to have some training and pass an exam that shows some competence in discrimination law and anti-harassment policies. A tremendous amount of teamwork has been done by the primary proponents from whom you'll hear later, and now Associated Oregon Industries and BOMA are both neutral on the bill after tremendous teamwork to help address their concerns. You may hear that the qualified rehabilitation facilities would like to be exempt from the bill. My feeling is that people with special needs need protection from sexual assault just as much as immigrant English language learning people who may be, or other cleaners who are working for janitorial companies. And so I don't think it would be appropriate to exempt these QRFs from the bill. And in fact, since they compete for contracts with businesses that are members of BOMA and AOI, from what I understand, if they were to be exempted, that would propel AOI and BOMA to actually move from their neutral position on the bill to an opposing position. So a ton of teamwork that is done to help a very fragile group of people could potentially be ripped asunder in a way that would be really devastating. So I hope you will give consideration to this bill. I know some of us have to get to the floor, but this is so important. I hope you will try to find a way to listen in as much as you can. And I urge you to support this bill. There's no use of general funds for this bill. The bill levies, provides the ability for BOLI to have there be fees associated with the registry, with the licensing, that would cover the cost of the program. So although this got referred to Ways and Means, it is my understanding that it would be a self-funding program through other funds, not general funds. I am hopeful that you'll move it forward. Thank you so much. And if, with your leave, I will turn it over to the others who know more than me to answer technical questions, but I leave it to you.
I'm going to have some questions. Colleagues, questions? Representative, I'm happy to have you call up any of your technical experts. I have three questions right off the bat. The first one is, in my time here in the legislature, we have gone to extraordinary lengths to protect addresses and names. And if I understood your testimony correctly, the workers would have to give up their names and addresses, and you've got Ms. Hagan coming up behind you.
Thank you so much. I'm going to leave it to Ms. Hagan and the people who you feel are appropriate. I don't believe that I testified that the workers would be giving up their names, but there may have been
I thought that's what I heard you say.
In my words, okay. So I defer to Ms. Hagan.
Okay, Ms. Hagan.
Felisa Hagan from SEIU for the record. Senator Johnson, to answer your question, no, the workers' names and addresses will not be provided. What will be provided is a list of janitorial companies, their names and addresses. So currently, because there's such a low barrier to entry into the janitorial industry, you often find companies sort of operating without licenses, operating not having filed with the Secretary of State's office, sort of operating in the shadows, and this helps create a registry of the names of the employers so that BOLI can do audits and investigations, not the employees.
Okay. My next question is there a threshold on the number of employees? Would this sweep in all the way from a company with 150 employees down to a mom and pop that maybe has three?
Senator Johnson, members of the committee, no, there is no threshold on the number of employees, but it is narrowed to janitorial companies that subcontract. So it is not if you clean in-house. So, for example, a lot of small mom-and-pop businesses don't subcontract their janitorial. The employees of that facility clean in that facility. That's true also of similar things like malls, for example, is another example of this. So for the main mall space, you'll have a subcontracted cleaning firm of whatever size, and then the individual mall stores, like if you work at a Macy's or what have you, then they will clean inside in-house, and those companies are exempted from the legislation.
Is Representative, please.
I can wait for your follow-up. I just
is this just commercial, or is this cleaning firms that do, for example, at some of the resorts, there are cleaning firms that do residential?
Senator Johnson, members of the committee, this is subcontracted janitorial company, so it doesn't distinguish from if you do large commercial spaces. So you're cleaning a resort, for example, they can subcontract that work. If you are cleaning at a resort, typically those janitors often are in-house in the industry and not subcontracted, so they're often housekeepers. So
I'm not sure I understood your answer. Let's take Sun River, for example,
yes,
that has individual homes and may have contract cleaners to do those homes at the preference of the owner, or how is that going to work?
Senator Johnson, members of the committee, those are different types of companies. So if you contract with Cottage Care, for example, cleaning company, I used to work at Cottage Care. I used to clean private homes for a good portion of my life. And for example, they don't clean, they're not a subcontracted janitorial company. They're a cleaning company, which is a different category in the law. So, but if I worked for ABM, for example, Associated Building Maintenance, that's typically a commercial janitorial company. However, if you do hire ABM to clean your home, they won't take the contract in practical settings. Most of those janitorial companies won't take the contract. And they don't have the sort of licensure to clean that type of facility, like insurance and things like that, so they typically don't want to clean your house. But if you did, perhaps you had a huge house, then they would be covered by the bill.
Okay, and one last question. Representative Leininger made reference to the fact that this is self-funding and that it would be done by fees. What is the assurance that there's going to be a reasonableness or a cap on the fees imposed by BOLI? And I presume they're going to try to do that by rule, or is that spelled out in the bill?
Senator Johnson, members of the committee, the fees that BOLIAs and POSAs will be set in rule, they'll be based on the cost that BOLI put forward for the legislative fiscal office. And when you add up all of the fees, divide that by the number of legally operating companies in the state, currently the fee is about $250. BOLI believes that the fee actually might be less than that, but I feel like the 250 number is a much safer number as we go into rulemaking.
Is BOLI operating on a cost recovery, or do they attempt to make this a revenue source?
Senator Johnson, members of the committee, I can speak to, you should ask the BOLI that question, but I think that this is about cost recovery, not about a revenue source for BOLI.
And will BOLI have a public and formal rule writing process that includes members of the class that will be paying the fees?
Senator Johnson, members of the committee, BOLI was part of the work group that included members of the class that will be paying the fees. So the Building Owners and Managers Association is actually in support of the bill. I think that that's different than Representative Leininger's testimony, and AOI is also actually in support of the bill. Both of those organizations contain members of the class who will be paying the fee. They also we've discussed the fee at length, actually, and those folks feel fine moving forward with the bill. You'll also see testimony in your packets from they've changed their name, but it's Portland, formerly known as Portland Habilitation Center, in your packet, who also feels comfortable moving forward with the bill. So my hope is that given their participation throughout this process, that they'll continue to participate in the rulemaking and setting of the fee schedule. But you
respectfully, you didn't answer my question. I'm going to ask representative from BOLI to come forward. I would like some reassurance on the record that the people paying the fee will be included in the rule writing that sets the fees. Would you come forward, please?
You're in charge.
Are they calling you?
I just hear that mysterious energy from my house floor.
Oh, okay.
Co-Chair Please. Johnson, Co-Chair Gomberg, members of the committee, for the record, Paloma Sparks with the Bureau of Labor and Industries. One, in response to your question, yes, they will be involved in the rulemaking process. We will have a public process. We will have an advisory committee. If there's interest, I'm sure we could have hearings. I have a feeling that just having the folks in the room who will be impacted by that will probably be enough without needing to have public hearings. Just to clarify something, there's been some discussions about the fiscal. Certainly, we will have a licensing fee, and going forward, once the program is underway and once we're collecting those fees, certainly that will be how we pay for the program going forward. The initial cost of, we will have to have staff in place who will start processing licenses prior to having sufficient fee revenue collected to pay for that position. So we will need to have some startup costs provided because we simply don't have the funds to pay for that other than fee.
And what do you estimate those startup costs to be?
Let's see, what was
in the...
It was about $170,000 in the first biennium and $220,000 in the second biennium. I'm not sure about the second biennium. I think as we discussed about fee revenue coming in, that may be something we need to take a second look at, but certainly in that first biennium when we have to hire staff before we have fee revenue in, that's not something that the agency can absorb.
I'm going to ask the professional staff to comment, please.
Madam Co-Chair, Mr. Co-Chair, and members of the committee, there are going to be some initial costs, the ending fund balances, which is traditional in agencies for them to borrow from other funds to get some startup funds. The funds that Ms. Sparks is referring to also include some IT costs that are not required by this bill, but that the department believes that would be beneficial to facilitate licensure, but because they're not required, we didn't include those in our fiscal.
Colleagues, sorry, Representative Noble, and I apologize for exercising the prerogative of the chair to play through.
Your prerogative. Thank you. I do also have a lot of questions, but I'm going to try and limit it to just a couple. I use this a lot, so I apologize kind of. Coming from law enforcement, I'm trying to find the nexus for registration to actually reducing the incidence of sexual assault. I'm not getting that connection.
Yeah, Senator Johnson, Representative Noble. I think so. The nexus for us, I should actually start a little bit with my testimony because I think it will help explain some stuff. I kind of just jumped in here to question and answer.
Please do.
SKU Local 49, we have about 3,000 janitors in our union. We represent about 80% of the commercial janitorial market in the Tri-County area. I think that Representative Leininger laid out that these workers often are working alone at night, immigrants. And so working in law enforcement, you know that that women who are sexually assaulted often do not come forward to report those assaults. We also know that Oregon has the second highest rate of sexual assault in the country, and that many of those sexual assaults actually happen at work. There's a U.S. estimated average that about 8% of rapes happen at work. Our union has experienced this with our own workers. As we have moved forward, California reached out to us after the Frontline documentary was created and their experiences. And Representative Leininger alluded to the 15 who came forward, who experienced sexual assault and harassment, who are currently in a lawsuit. We have others who've come forward who've actually experienced sexual assault and rape on their jobs. And I'll get to the nexus in just a second.
That maybe we can answer this offline. I guess I'm just looking for an actual way to reduce it. I understand that they occur. I understand the ugliness of it. And maybe we could discuss this offline with maybe other industries where we've done something similar with simply a registry that's reduced incidents of sex assault. I do have a second question, though.
Sure. If you don't mind, I think the committee is interested in knowing what that nexus is.
I just want to respect the committee's time, so I'm good with that, too.
Yes.
Please continue, Ms. Hagan.
So, Senator Johnson, members of the committee. So, I think the nexus is, so the Registry X really exists for three other industries in our state who have high have workforce issues. So a registry exists for construction, forestry, and farm labor. There's been a lot of sexual assault in the farm labor industry as well. And so we're just adding janitorial contractors to those current existing registries. So the registry in combination with the training, I'm not sure that it is going to prevent sexual assault. And I'm going to be frank about that right now. What I think it's going to help with a registry and training is going to help with is what happens to a victim or a survivor when they've been sexually assaulted. So there's a level of deterrent just by having a mandatory training that employers do that help educate their workforces about sexual assault. The second piece of it creates a situation where people are educated where they actually come forward and speak out about sexual assault, which we all know is a problem in our state and throughout the country. And I don't believe that, I hope that that deters behavior as we have more victims or survivors coming forward and that we can immediately address the issue and have an attacker taken out of the workplace before they have repeated assaults. So for example, Raina, who was our worker who's gonna come today, she's not here, she had an issue with her child. I also think it's very difficult for a survivor to come and talk in front of these committees, so I want to respect that. And she did testify in front of House Judiciary, and I encourage you. Her attacker harassed her for months on the job. He followed her around. He showed up in her car. He touched her and told her no one was going to believe her before he finally raped her in a bathroom where she worked. And had she been, I think, had more education in what to do when a coworker does that, if the janitorial company that she worked for had more education and a policy about what to do previously, I think that maybe he would have been taken out of the workplace before he raped her in a bathroom.
Sure. May I follow up? Was he criminally convicted?
No. Senator Johnson, no.
Were charges pressed? That's a crime.
Senator Johnson, I understand that's a crime. We explained to Raina that that's a crime. I think that it's up to her to step forward and prosecute that. And I think Representative Noble, Representative Olson, Representative Springer, Representative Barker, we've talked about the level of proof that you need to have in a one-on-one assault case. There aren't video cameras in these places. There's no video cameras in the bathroom of commercial office buildings. There's no one there from the hours of, 7 p.m., 8 p.m. at night to 3 or 4 o'clock in the morning. Mm-hmm. And there's no one on the floor with you, as Representative Leininger expressed, besides you and your attacker. And so I think the folks who work in law enforcement can talk about the difficulty of coming forward with a he said, she said sexual assault case. And I think that every member that we have talked to, we've encouraged them to come forward, but it is an incredibly difficult task to do.
Representative Noble, please continue.
Yeah, I would agree. Just there's a stigma, and I think that's as much as anything else, and societal ideas about how law enforcement does deal with it. I know they're getting better. My concern, though, is in asking the question is setting up a false sense of security, because it happens everywhere.
Yes.
It's not limited to certain industries. It's not limited to certain socioeconomic status. It's not limited to racial minorities or any other minority. It happens everywhere. And I'd hate to set up a false sense of security for people who are working in this industry. The other question I have deals with a comment Representative made about nonprofits, because I have been contacted by nonprofits.
Yeah.
And I noticed that oftentimes, my experience, because we hired out in police departments some of these nonprofits to do some of our work as required by law, oftentimes they employ individuals who would not be otherwise employable by ABM or some others.
Absolutely.
And I noticed that you have some exemptions on page 3, starting at line 5, talking about educational institutions, labor unions, the employment department, yet I see that pretty close nexus to the same mission that a nonprofit would have. Can you help me with that one?
Yes. Senator Johnson, Representative Noble, the exemptions that are laid out in the bill are actually exemptions that are in the statute generally, and those are for in-house cleaning. So if you are a labor union nonprofit business, that's the exemption for in-house cleaning. So because labor unions are not defined as a business and nonprofits aren't defined as a business. So if a QRF, which most qualified rehabilitation facilities had in-house cleaning, like their own staff cleaned the building, just like if we cleaned our own building, we would be exempt from the bill. If you are selling subcontracted janitorial services, so like in the police department, you don't clean your own building, you hire a qualified rehabilitation facility based on the law to clean your building, they would not be exempt from the bill. We heard from the Oregon Rehabilitation Association, and Nan is here, that they actually wanted to be part of the training portion of the bill, because they think it would be helpful for the folks who are part of their industry. As I think Representative Leininger discussed, is a very vulnerable population. And in fact, we worked on the bill so that making sure the cultural competency component was in there, so that when we're doing trainings or having trainings with disabled folks, that those trainings reflect the group that you're training. So we don't want to have the same training for ABM that we might have for a qualified rehabilitation facility, because their folks have different needs than an ABM.
And one other comment is, this is more of a comment. I guess that, and I absolutely believe that we should train. I do also know that between FLSA, BOLI, workers' comp, OSHA, there are trainings that are already required by law without a registry. And so that would be my comment, because I'm still not convinced that a registry by itself would do a whole lot more than create a false sense of security for, as you mentioned, a very vulnerable population. So I'm willing to talk more offline if that's necessary.
Representative Meek.
Thank you, Co-Chair. And I just want to thank Representative Leininger and Ms. Hagan for the work you've done.
Yeah.
And I think it's definitely vital that we do part of the issue of getting these folks to comply or being educated is they're not, we don't know who they are, and they may not be licensed. And I think to have them register is important as an important first step to identify and so that we can get the education process started. Otherwise, it's in a vacuum, and there's no accountability at all. And so I don't know if it will preclude future assaults, but I do think it's a great beginning point, and I appreciate the work you've done, and I encourage you to continue, and I'm very supportive of this, and I hope we get this passed.
Thank you.
Senator Johnson, Representative Noble, I know you're headed to the House, so I want to also answer the question, because I think the registry is a big question, why the registry. So the other part of the registry that's key, and is key in farm labor and forestry and construction as well, is it's how you certify that they've actually completed the training requirement. So that we know that they've gone through those trainings. And so not every industry actually does have mandatory trainings on sexual assault or harassment. And in fact, mainly only industries that have federal contracts. Representative Leininger is working on passing a bill right now that, of course, we're very supportive of, that it includes state contracts. But there's a whole host of janitors who work in the private sector, who are contracted by commercial building owners or other folks, who there is no requirement. And that's why we worked with BOMA in this bill, because it also helps reduce liability for those contractors and encourages them to hire off of a registry to create that level of accountability.
And Chair Johnson, Co-Chair Johnson, Co-Chair Gomberg, I think the registry is important to also, one, because it enables you to know who has completed the certification and the training requirements to prevent the harm in the first place, but also if there is a problem and someone has been attacked and they want to bring a lawsuit to seek justice, or they want to report it to law enforcement to seek justice, if you don't have tangible information about who your employer is, who the boss is of the operation, then it's much harder to seek to have the laws enforced. So having a registry in a very low barrier to entry, easy to dissolve set of subcontracted businesses helps make clear and memorialize who's in charge. Who is in charge of that situation? Who was in charge the day that Raina was assaulted? Did they do something wrong? Did they fail to have the right training? And so I think if we want to stop this contact, we have to train people. We also have to signal that if you own a company or you operate a business where there's a predator and you didn't take action, or you need to have the police come and make sure that a predator is held to account, they need to know who to talk to, and the registry helps get that done. And so I strongly believe that that's an important part of this operation.
You made a reference that causes me to ask, is there a private right of action in this lawsuit? In this bill?
Senator Johnson, members of the committee, no, but there currently is generally, if you are assaulted, you can choose an attorney.
Crime.
Yeah. Yes.
Okay. And then for you, Ms. Higgins, is it customary for labor unions to use in-house folks to clean their facilities?
Senator Johnson, members of the committee, no, actually it's not customary at all. In fact, most labor unions subcontract, and so labor unions who subcontract, like my own union, for example, we subcontract our service to a union janitorial firm, and we would be subject to this as well. So our janitor would be part of his employer would be registered. We would hire off the registry. He would be trained. There's a couple of exceptions. The plumbers and pipe fitters, local UA290, they have very specialized equipment in their facility, so they have two janitors who work in-house who clean their custodians, and they maintain their specialized equipment as well. So it's a little bit of a different take, but most labor unions subcontract and so would be subject to this.
Then I misunderstood again. I thought that you were exempted.
Senator Johnson, members of the committee, no, labor unions ourselves, if we clean in-house, just like if you are a business that cleans in-house, a school district that cleans in-house, like you hire, the Portland Public School District hires custodians. So the Portland Public School District would be exempted because those are direct employees of the school district. They're already required to, under other law, to have this sort of type of training, as Senator Monroe can attest to. if the Portland Public School District decided next week that we're going to subcontract all of the janitors in our school district, whoever they subcontracted to would not be required to go through those trainings. And so then this bill would then require them to be part of the training. Okay. That's the exemption in the bill.
Thank you. We're rapidly running out of committee. Representative Noble, do you have a question?
One comment. I don't want to, I want to make sure I appreciate, you know that I appreciate the work.
Yeah.
Anything to reduce the incidence of sexual assault would be a high priority for me. I just want to make sure that what we're doing doesn't give a false sense of security, that it's actually effective in reducing those incidents, especially late night when people are vulnerable and a population that's vulnerable.
Senator Johnson, Representative Noble, I agree, and I really hope it actually allows people to come a little bit out of the shadow when something does happen to them in a timely manner so that we can address that swiftly.
Thank you very much. Please feel free, Representative Noble, to go to the floor. We'll stay here. We have two more people signed up, three more people signed up. I would invite forward Mr. Dale and Mr. Ramirez, please. While they're getting seated, we picked up the sign-in. Are there others that are wishing to testify that did not sign in? Okay, please, Mr. Dale.
Chair Johnson, I guess not Chair Gomberg, because he's hearing over it. Chair Johnson and members of the committee, my name is Michael Dale. I'm an attorney. I've worked mostly in legal services more recently for over the last 15 years or so for the Northwest Worker Justice Project, which is a nonprofit that represents low-wage contingent workers. I have filed written testimony, and given the press of time, I just kind of cut to the chase, and that is to simply say that these statutes were originally developed in the context of farm labor and reforestation labor at a time when those industries were the Wild West, when they were completely unregulated. I'm not here to say that everything's absolutely cleaned up and there's no problem at all, but believe me, it's not like it was in 1980. And these statutes have had a salutary effect in beginning to get a hold of some of these things. Now, I can't talk to the question of particularly sexual assault because the emphasis on sexual assault is new to this bill, and I think it's a good thing. It's long past due and will help in those industries as well. What I can talk to is how the process of registration in those industries has had the effect of limiting people who are providing labor services in these industries to responsible providers. And that goes, to answer Representative Noble's question, that goes a long way toward preventing abuse. If you've got an industry where there's a very low barrier to entry and there's no one paying any attention to, like, who's doing what and that sort of thing, you know, you have folks that are great employers and do well, but you also have folks that just are irresponsible and unaccountable. And the net effect of this has been to really improve the situation in certainly in forestry and agriculture. A couple years ago, construction was added to the list. It's not really fully integrated into the system yet, but I think it will be beneficial there as well. And so I, good bill to pass.
Thank you very much. Mr. Ramirez?
Yeah. Madam Chair and members of the committee, my name is Ramon Ramirez. I'm president of the Oregon Farm Worker Union, PECUN. And on behalf of our 6,500 members, we're in support of House Bill 3279. PECUN is a farm worker union, and so we work to improve the living and working conditions of farm workers.
However, you know, even though this bill does not cover farm workers, we do support it because what we're seeing in the industry is there's a shift from farm labor to office cleaning. And some of the same contractors that work, that operate in farm labor are operating as janitor or office cleaning services, using farm workers in many cases to clean those buildings. And many of those people that clean the building are women. I got to tell you that that I first cut my teeth here in this building in 1982, working on the same legislation that Michael Dale was talking about, improving the farm labor contractor registry, and it has really gone a long ways to improve the industry overall, and especially to protect the rights of workers. So we have so we're concerned that a lot of our folks that are leaving agriculture to do this work in the offices many times are victimized. We recently, in the last few years, been involved with the Oregon Law Center in doing a project to document and also to do a Know Your Rights training to women, especially indigenous farm worker women. And what we found was wholesale violations of people's rights in terms of sexual harassment and actually rape in the fields. There's a documentary called Rape in the Fields that was produced by OPB and Univision. And I would suggest to the senators that, or the rest of the committee that's left, that they should actually see that documentary. And it gives you an idea of the problems that we're addressing. What we found, and there has, you know, even though there's been cases of rape and major cases of sexual harassment, there hasn't been any criminal cases against the perpetrators of these crimes, and they are crimes, like you say, Madam Chair. However, in four of the cases, we have EEOC from San Francisco office that represents the district here. I have filed lawsuits against employers where a lot of these crimes have happened. What's happened is that those cases are settled out of court, so there's no criminal proceedings afterwards. However, we think that it's time for the industry to get we got to find out who these employers are working for, or employees are working for. A lot of the times that we're interviewing people didn't even know who they were working for. So I think that it's time for this industry, especially the janitorial and office cleaning industry, to come to basically do what's happening in farm labor. So that's why we strongly support this legislation.
Thank you very much. Ms. Hebb, we still have somebody else signed up to testify. If you could be brief, please.
I'll be very brief, Chair Johnson and members of the committee. My apologies for not signing up earlier. I was in conflict.
I've signed you up.
I appreciate it. Thank you. And just wanted to offer my support for the principles and the practice under the bill, and Sybil Hebb for the Oregon Law Center in support of the bill. Thank you, Michael. And I think just to echo that, these are some of the most devastating cases to hear about coming into our office. As you know, many of our clients struggle with domestic or sexual violence issues. They come to our offices seeking help and safety. And when a person is violated at the workplace, not only is her physical and mental health impacted, also so is the economic security of herself and her family. And when those things all come together, just the impacts are just devastating. And so employers really have, and the workplace really has, a role to play, and I think this bill will really help ensure some standards and practices that will lead to greater safety. So we appreciate the attention to it. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Any questions for this panel? Thank you. Last but not least, Ms. Heim.
Thank you, Chair Johnson and members of the committee. My name is Nan Heim, and I represent the Oregon Resource Association. Our members are nonprofit programs across the state that provide employment and housing services to thousands of Oregonians with intellectual and developmental disabilities. And I appreciate this opportunity to clarify our position on this bill. Our association is neutral on House Bill 3279A. There has been some confusion. It is true that when this bill first came out before the House Judiciary Committee, I testified in opposition to it as it was introduced, and proposed an amendment to exempt nonprofits that provide janitorial services. We have about 65 members. Fewer than half of those have met the qualifications to become qualified rehabilitation facilities and contract with public agencies to provide various services. And then some of those provide janitorial services. We proposed an exemption for nonprofits, feeling that our workforce was different and that our mode of operation was different. It became apparent that that amendment would not pass in the House Judiciary Committee. As Representative Leiniger said, she wanted us covered in the bill. The Speaker wanted us covered in the bill. And when that became clear, we were encouraged to meet with the bill's supporters, SEIU, and other interested parties, and see if we could come to some agreement on some provisions of the bill that we particularly were concerned about. One of them, for example, was there is usually a bonding requirement for contractors that have to be licensed by BOLI. And that has been waived. That's potentially very expensive for our members, and as I think most of you know, they're financially holding on barely. That was taken care of. The working alone provision is a concern to some of our members because there are some mental disabilities that make it impossible for them to work as part of a team. So janitorial services have worked very well for some of our programs that employ these individuals, and they can work alone. That doesn't mean they're not supervised. There's a supervisor who checks on them. But we wanted them to be able to work alone. That was taken care of in the amendments. We wanted to clarify the addresses, whose addresses would be given up. That was taken care of. We asked that the annual fee be kept below $250. That is not specific. In the bill, there's a concern about that for some of the smaller programs, but we're assured that at least initially it will be. So with those changes, our association is neutral on this bill. Not all the programs that do this work belong to our association, so I can't speak for them, but our association is neutral on the bill as amended. I'd be happy to answer questions.
Thank you. Any questions? I appreciate your testimony. I represent three facilities in Senate District 16 that are both, in some cases, residential and rehabilitative. And I know what pride those workers take in a job well done, regardless of the fact that some of us might deem it menial. For them, is it a source of pride and accomplishment? Given the disparity of salary between some of the state-supported workers in the DD arena and the private not-for-profits that, as you pointed out, are just barely hanging on and are in many cases relying on the generosity of strangers to make donations to remain financially viable, it concerns me greatly that any additional costs heaped on those not-for-profits could be the tipping point. And when I think of the populations served by the three facilities in my district, the pain of losing those facilities if they were driven out of business by additional regulatory or financial burden would be catastrophic. I don't know where those people go. And in rural Oregon, we have no alternatives in many instances. So my concern about the bill certainly doesn't stem from any issues protecting vulnerable populations working alone at night. That's a flat no-brainer. My concern is additional costs on these fragile providers of essential services to a highly specialized population. If I were queen, they would be cut out of the bill as just a prophylactic against any financial damage. But given that the speaker and the sponsor of the bill have made it pretty clear that that's not an alternative, I would hope that you and your interested clients stay involved in the rulemaking, and that you should have a clear path back to the legislature if it turns out that you are financially disadvantaged or regulatorily, I just made that word up, I think, disadvantaged. I think all of us support the notion of making sure that people are not abused in the workplace, but I think the loss of a job could result in abuse for some of these DD populations for whom this work is meaningful work. All right. Anybody else moved by the spirit of testimony? Right on the dot. I am going to close the public hearing on House Bill 3279. Anything from the professional staff?
No, thank you, Senator.
Anything from you, colleagues?
Nope.
All right. We're adjourned.
Trump has an opening on his vocabulary.